All right, let's do this. How are you? What the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucksters? What's going on? How is it going? How is your day? Where are you at? Are you working? Are you not working? Are you having a hard time adjusting to work? Are they wearing masks? Are they not wearing masks? Where are you at with things? Helen Hunt is on the show today. Yes, Helen Hunt. She's in the new Starz series, Blindspotting, which is based out, actually based on the movie that came out a few years ago with Daveed Diggs, who was on the show talking about that movie. But obviously, she's also an Oscar winner, an Emmy winner, showbiz lifer from when she was a kid, and a filmmaker in her own right. And it was sort of interesting when you get opportunities to talk to these people. And I've said that before. You know, I get the pitch, you want to talk to Helen Hunt? I'm like, yeah, of course. She's Helen Hunt. Got to talk to Helen Hunt. I enjoy talking to her. It's nice to see her face to face. She came in. Well, I'll share that with you momentarily. How you doing? You all right? How the kids? How's the cats? How's the dog? How's the bird? How's the lizard? What happened to your snake? What's going on with that fish? How's your mom? How's your dad? How's your grandpa? How's your grandma? How's your brother? How's your stepbrother? How's your stepsister? Who are you? I'm a he. I'm an it. I'm a they. I'm a that. I got to get that straight. Do I got to get that straight? Watching the stand-up, doing the stand-up, a little bit angry. I don't know what to... Mike Tyson and Bobby Brown were at the club last night. I didn't say anything to him. I saw Mike walk out. It's intense. You know, when Mike walks down the hallway, you're kind of like, shit, man. This is Mike Tyson. He's like, excuse me. Got no problem. No problem, champ. Yeah, it's been okay, man. I'm okay. The cats are okay. I'm still on this sugar detox. I was having trouble breathing fully for like a week, and I don't know if it was all part of the physical trip of taking away all that sugar. I don't know, but I'm okay now. It seems to be coming back around. Maybe it was just because I was being suffocated from within out of panic and stress about any number of things. I still don't have a clear handle on how not to sort of psychosomatic symptoms of stress. If I'm overwhelmed, if I get anxious, like I feel like my lungs are in a vice, and I don't even know what it is. I think it's just part of the adjustment. I did comedy every fucking night last week, and it's dragging me back into a time of brain that I'm not sure I need to be back in. You know, I'm not all warm and cuddly and open like I usually am. Do I have the wrong idea of myself? I'm not joyous and free and all embracing and just like, you know, when I'm on stage, it's like witnessing a giant hug. I'm not doing that anymore. I don't know what happened to that guy. Am I making that guy up? So Dean Del Rey and myself seem to be doing a podcast together. It's either every 2 weeks. It might end up being once a month. It might end up being, I don't know. Whatever the case, there are three of them up there. Dark Fonzie number 3 is up. It's me and Del Rey. I call him No Scuff Dean. He calls me Moody Mark. Those are the new nicknames for the latest. But whatever. Go get it where you get podcasts. I know it's at Apple Podcasts, wherever you get them. Well, I'm not in charge of it. Dean is. Dark Fonzie, me and Del Rey, shooting the shit about corduroy pants, rock and roll, concerts, leather, dog, anal glands came up. You know, the deep stuff. Dark Fonzie number 3 up now. Did I tell you guys about the painting? Let's get into this. It's kind of an interesting story. A guy reached out to me on Instagram through the DMs. A guy in Seattle had found a painting at an estate sale by a Lynn Shelton. He showed me the painting. I had no sense of size. And he showed me the painting and he showed me the signature. Lynn Shelton, 9/16/83. Now, I assume that was a date, but I didn't know. I didn't know anything about it. And I was trying to figure out how old she would have been. The Lynn Shelton that I loved. And could it be her? I know she had done some drawings, some paintings. She done some photography. I know it was possible, but he picked this thing up at an estate sale. And I said, I don't know, but I want it. You know, I mean, if it's her, it'd be a nice thing to have. You want to send it to me? I'll pay you back for it. He said, just if you could just pay shipping. I'm like, fine. So then he tells me the shipping after this, a few days later, the shipping comes to $192. And I'm like, Jesus, no problem. Yeah, I'll take care of it. And I PayPal'd him the money. And then a few days later, maybe a week later, this giant box comes. Giant. And I unpack this huge, beautifully framed, I think it's a painting. It's on paper. It's a work on paper. It might be a print. It's still not clear to me. It's an abstract. And it's big and it's beautifully mounted, like old timey kind of fabric mat, linen mat or whatever. And it's a stunning abstract, and abstract's not easy, but this is a beautifully conceived abstract print or painting. And I looked at the signature. I'm like, it says Lynn Shelton. It's 1983, but this seems to be, you know, she would have been, I don't know, just out of high school. And it seems a little fully realized for a 17 or 18 year old person to create this print. And then I could see there was an imprint on the paper, and I took a picture of the imprint under the signature, and I flipped it on my phone. It's a high end type of milled paper for printing or painting. Give me no real insight. I Googled Lynn Shelton painter, and it came up with one auction painting. An abstract that gave no details, but it led me to believe, or know anyways, that there was a Lynn Shelton out there painting at that time, or that one was from the 60s, and it was just a mystery. So I texted her friend, Jennifer. I sent a picture of the signature and the painting, and Jennifer, you know, contacted Lynn's brother, and Lynn's brother was like, I don't know. I don't know if she painted. She would have been, you know, in 83. It would have been like in between high school and her going to Oberlin. So I'm thinking like maybe she took a class with a printmaker or a master. It was still sort of possible in my mind. Her brother, you know, passed it along to Lynn's mom, who said, I don't remember her doing any painting. It seems like it's probably not her. And then in the meantime, I had my people on IG, on Instagram, go looking. And a couple of people came up with that painting that I had found, the one painting that had been at auction. A few other people came up with a New York Times article, I think from the late 70s, that involved a Lynn Shelton painter who worked with furniture, actually covered furniture with paper and painted it. And then somebody found a picture of one of those pieces, of a piece of furniture covered with paper in a way, but not like collage-like. It was a very specific, unique thing, but it had an abstract sensibility. And that person had found a signature that looked like the signature on my print. So I'm pretty sure that it's Lynn Shelton, a painter who's a guy, but there's very limited information. He was involved in a New York Times article about some exhibition he was involved in, and it might be his painting that was up on that auction site from 1965, but I have this beautiful print that's huge. And I've really taken a liking to it. I hung it up in my bedroom. It's hard to decide what you hang in your bedroom. But all of it was hinging on this idea that Lynn could have done it. Lynn Shelton, the one that I knew and loved, could have done it. But also that she would have liked this painting. I have a piece of art that she had bought not long before she passed away. That's an abstract piece of encaustic sculpture that has sort of definitely an abstract vibe. It hangs on the wall. It's a block of a sculpture with lines. And I think she would have liked this abstract that by Lynn Shelton, the painter, has some weird depth to it and a slight bit of darkness and a kind of like a chasm into space effect that I find compelling, but there's color in it. And I think Lynn Shelton, the film director, would have liked it. And I really like it. So it was destined to be with me from this estate sale that we know nothing about, just that it was in Seattle and that it was framed in Seattle, probably in the 80s. Strange story about the Lynn Shelton painting that it's found a home on my wall. But I really appreciate all the fans. I appreciate that guy finding me and getting me the painting, and I appreciate all the amateur sleuths that helped me piece it together. I love it. So, look, you guys, it was fun to talk to Helen Hunt. She's in this new Starz series, Blindspotting, which premieres next Sunday, June 13th. It's always interesting to talk to somebody. And then now that people are coming back over again, you know, you've got the before she sits down here or they, and then after they talk. There's conversation that happens on both sides of those that sometimes is more revealing than the conversation we have in here. But that's just the nature of stuff. I've been on my way out, walking someone out, and literally said, shit, do you want to, I think we should put that on the mics, don't you? And they're like, no, or yeah. But needless to say, it was nice to get to know her both on the mics and off the mics. This is me talking to Helen Hunt. I think people have gotten comfortable with the masks.
Yeah.
I don't think it's a bad thing, I guess, to wear a mask.
And the teenagers.
Yeah. About them?
They're used to wearing them now.
Oh, really?
Like, I have friends with kids who, even though they're getting vaccinated, are too freaked to take them off.
Really?
Yeah.
The kids are getting, well, they're the kind of the last group to get vaxxed, right?
Yeah, but I think if you're in a mask for your 16th year, it's different than if you're in a mask for your 56th year. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
that's
a
big year.
Yeah, 16.
To have your face covered.
Do you have kids? Or
I have a 17-year-old daughter.
So how did she take it?
You know, as well as somebody can take it. I just felt like I spent the whole thing like with one eye on her. Like, is she going down? Is she? What must she be thinking?
In terms of mentally?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like the apocalyptic fucking thing.
Yeah.
She looked early on. She said, "I said, it's gonna be okay."
Yeah.
She said, "You don't know that."
Yeah. See,
and
she's
I said,
right.
"You're right." I almost know it.
Yeah. Almost.
Yeah.
I find that people say that, and like, it's a nice thing to say.
And it's often true.
Yeah. You got by 70%.
The alternative as a mother is to a lot of hand wringing and what if the sky's falling.
And panicking and then destabilizing their ability to.
Yeah. So I went with column A.
Yeah. Yeah. Stability and, you know, why not?
Yeah.
You got to lie a little bit.
Yeah.
But that must, is it exciting having a kid that age at this time? Do you find that, because I don't have kids.
Yeah.
And I think you and I are about the same age. Do you find that you have no idea what they're up to or into or what's happening?
As of a week ago. Really? Like the switch flicked.
Yeah.
And I feel like I don't know what's in her head anymore. And so I'm trying to not just be the devouring mother who's in your business, but I also don't want to be so in my lane that I am not there.
Yeah.
So it's like you fall off that surfboard a lot.
What switch?
I guess I'm getting ready for empty net. I'm leaving I better really change the way I do things, because in 1 year, I'm an adult who lives alone. I'm guessing that's what it is.
I just mean, like, you know, how they take in media. Like, I'm starting to realize, like, I have no idea how show business works anymore, really?
Yeah, no, I don't either. And all I do is hand her my phone. First of all, where are my glasses?
Right.
I don't have them. Can you do it? And second of all, how do you do it?
Right.
Yeah.
It's wild, right?
It's so predictable. I would like to beat the dealer, but I just don't think it's going to happen.
Is it all age, or is it that because it's really kind of like untethered, like this whole media landscape? I have no idea.
Both.
Yeah.
Both.
But how many of you've done the Blind Spotting show? Have you shot how many?
They made 8 and I'm in 6.
Because I saw the movie and I talked to David.
Oh, you did? Did you like the movie?
Yeah, I did.
I
don't know, what is the series then?
It's, I mean, I think it has all the good DNA of the movie and all the good of completely reimagining it.
Right.
So anybody who didn't see the movie, it's Rafael Casal and David Diggs.
Yeah.
In real life, best friends, grew up in Oakland. In the movie, different best friends.
Right.
Grew up in Oakland. And it's David's character's last 5 days on parole.
Yeah.
But his white friend, is much more likely to go off and be violent and get him in trouble. So
right.
It's the tension of those 5 days.
Okay.
That's the movie.
Okay.
The TV series, in the first frame, Rafael's character gets arrested. And so it's the effect on everybody else that, you know,
the white guy
mass incarceration has on his son, his girlfriend, his mother, his sister, the whole, you know.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Not a comedy.
A total comedy. It is a comedy.
Oh, good.
Yeah. With dance and spoken word. It's
dance?
A trip. Yeah, it's a trip.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Have you ever seen this guy, Lil Buck?
Who do you play?
His mother.
Oh, you do.
His very woke, hippie, loud mother.
Is that fun?
So fun. So fun.
I don't see you as hippie loud. So is it a stretch?
It's me turned like off my leash.
Oh, okay, good.
Yeah. So that was amazing.
What were you going to ask me? Had I seen one?
I don't remember.
Oh,
it's gone.
See, yeah,
57.
Yeah.
Welcome to
this
57.
Goes. Yeah.
Have you seen a dancer named Lil Buck? Lilbuck.
No.
On Instagram.
No.
And a guy named John Boogs.
See,
I know.
Is,
see. I'm like the kids.
Yeah.
They're both incredible dancers, and they are the choreographers of this thing. So
people just break out into dance in the middle of things?
They kind of do. It's really good.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, I have to say.
Like, you've done a lot of stuff.
You're not kidding. I mean, in a minute, I'm going to have to watch that I don't say things like, I've been doing this for 50 years. Like, that's going to be something I'm really going to try not to say.
Yeah.
But it's going to be the truth in, like, a minute.
But you grew up in show business.
Yeah.
I mean, I talked to only a few people. I just talked to William Zabka, whose dad was the director of The Tonight Show in New York. But I've talked to Jodie Foster. I mean, you're more like her, kind of.
Yeah.
In that you were started when you were a child.
Yeah. I never had the success that she had when I was little, though. And I was never on a TV show. I wasn't that kid from...
The show?
It is enough, whatever. I was on a lot of shows that failed.
Right.
Which I take as a blessing, you know?
But didn't you do bit parts on, like, you know?
Everything. You IMDb'd me?
I did.
You probably ran out of time.
I looked at Wikipedia a little bit. But you were on all those shows that we watched when we were kids.
Some, and some you didn't watch or don't remember.
Yeah, but how did it, like, start?
It started because my dad was a director. And I was born here. I'm deep L.A., two generations back, Culver City.
Oh, Culver City.
My father and mother were both born in Pasadena 9 years apart, like deep L.A.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
That's so rare.
It's so rare.
I don't even understand what Pasadena is.
I don't either. I don't either. You live really close. You should figure it out.
Well, I used to live closer in Highland Park, but it's just, I knew that when I was looking for houses and I ended up in Glendale, I didn't want to be in Pasadena for some weird specific reason.
Just arbitrarily oppositional.
No, it felt like there was a kind of waspy kind of, you know, I know it's not like New England, mm-hmm. but it did feel like there was some sort of aristocracy in place over there.
Yeah, there's big houses there.
Yeah.
The West Side gets the rap for being big and white and fancy, but
no, Pasadena
is pretty big.
But in Glendale, there's some here, but it's like I don't get the sense that I don't know what the history exactly of Glendale is, but it seems like its own place. I don't feel threatened here.
My grandmother
yeah.
was nominated for an Emmy at the 3rd Annual Emmy Awards in like 1952.
Really?
She wrote and created a children's show that was on NBC Live 5 nights a week. Single mother.
Really?
Is that crazy?
It is crazy. So and whose mother is this?
My mother's mother.
Wow.
I know. And my father's parents lived in Pasadena. So it's some deep, deep, deep L.A. history.
But show business, too.
So back to what you were asking me. My dad was a director. We lived in New York City from age 3 to 9. That was my New York, like, imprint.
What was he directing there?
Little plays and off-Broadway
theaters. So that was the beginning of it? Him getting his chops?
Not his beginning. It was my beginning of being taken to, like, Godspell in the basement of a church before it was ever in a theater when I was 6. And they're handing out wine and painting each other's faces. And I was like, whatever this is.
It's the best, right?
I didn't have a thing of wanting to be an actor on stage. I just wanted to be in that room.
Yeah. For the rest of your life?
For the rest
painting
of my
faces
life.
And drinking wine?
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much.
You did almost.
I kind of did. I'm almost there. Who knows?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and he was directing plays?
He was directing plays, and so I would go to rehearsal with him.
Yeah.
And
big ones? Any big actors? Anything make an impression on you? You don't know.
I just liked being in that room.
Yeah, but you don't know what
drinking coffee.
Yes.
And, you know what I mean? It was more about that.
Yeah,
which
yeah.
kills me, because my daughter is not, she may very well not be an actor, but she loves the theater.
Yeah.
And it's all on Zoom. She did Romeo and Juliet on Zoom.
Oh, no.
Oh, I know.
Well, they're gonna be back.
They'll be out soon,
right?
Yeah, I hope she has a senior year that's real and in person.
So you didn't act then?
When I was studying ballet and I was studying acting, which was really just because someone in my family was. And so at age 9, I was in an acting class back in L.A. And there was a kind of 1 to 3 on Saturdays was the kid class, and 3 to 6 was the adult class.
Right.
And I begged her to take both.
Yeah.
Same thing. I just wanted to be in that room.
Yeah.
I didn't have any desire to work or act. I just wanted to be.
There was something cool about it, right?
I think it's the thing, which still is why I love going to plays, is that this challenging, scary, heartbreaking story happens in a safe container. Like that that cocktail.
Live, though.
Works, and live all the better.
But that feeling of, like, being fascinated with, like, behind the scenes, Like, I still feel that if I do anything television-oriented or if I make an appearance on a talk show.
Yeah.
That moment where you're just sitting there with people with real jobs.
Yeah, I know. I teach acting sometimes. And my dad taught acting for decades and decades, and he died, and I, with somebody else, a terrific other teacher, we took over the class. And I'm always telling them, you're going to be standing on a set and chatting.
Yeah.
And you'll be with the electrician, and he's chatting, and you're chatting. But at some point, you have to be a wild animal.
Yeah.
Like, he gets to be normal and hang lights and put filters up, but you have to make weird sounds and remember the darkest shit in your past and move your body. Like, and that's, I think, probably why I like acting, is you have to be a little bit feral to do it.
Interesting.
And I like that.
I want to understand that, because I've been doing some acting. You know, feral in the sense of like I understand the idea that. How is it feral, exactly?
I mean, for me,
it's
in my body, it's in my voice, it's in, I use stuff from my dreams.
So the rawness at the core of it all.
Yeah.
That you've got to show up in this and manifest this thing.
Yeah, and if you're making decisions about the scene from the neck up,
how
fun is that to watch?
Yeah, what are you doing with your hands?
Yeah. But if you're using some dream where you crossed a street with a cat next to you and the cat clawed you and that's coming up in the scene, there's something wild and unruly and unsafe about that. People always say, what was it like to work with Jack Nicholson? I think that he to me is the perfect cocktail of sat in acting class in New York City for 100 years, knows the basic stuff. What does the character want? Where were they 1 minute ago? But also, it's like that feeling like a wild thing walked on stage. And so when those two are together, that's my favorite kind of acting.
Right, that's the present, to be present.
Yeah, but I think you need the...
All the other stuff.
...balls to be present, but you also need the craft. You need to know how to do it on take 10 and on the 8th
Keep
show of the week.
For it. Yeah. Yeah, that was sort of like, that was an interesting sort of time for Nicholson, I think. Because it seems like that was sort of the beginning of the old Nicholson. Right?
The beginning of the older, you mean as a person older? I guess so.
Yeah, kind of.
He did that Nancy Myers movie after, which he was incredible in. Something's Gotta Give.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
cutting
the
turtleneck off of Diane Keaton.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do.
They were both so good.
No, he's great. I miss him.
Me too.
Do you talk to him?
No. Mm. We never were social, but they'd say go, and we had we had something.
Yeah, I just like... I miss him at the Oscars.
Yeah, I know. Because somebody's in there who might do something crazy.
Just even him sitting there in the front. I don't know who any of those people are anymore.
I don't either.
But when we were growing up, it was a great
Jack
thing
Nicholson.
To watch.
I know.
They're all sitting there.
I went through that whole award thing with him, and that's fun.
That must have been great.
Hunts.
And you won.
He used to call me Hunts.
And you won, right?
We both won.
Oh, he won too?
Yeah.
Was he fun?
He, you know what I remember is he was in a thing with Jim Brooks about...
Oh, Jim told me
I actually remember what it was.
Yeah.
Was it noodle salad and that whole thing?
I don't remember, but I talked to Jim about him spending time with Jack on that thing.
Yeah. They got in some headlock over something that might seem small but meant the world to both of them. It may have been whether you say noodle pudding or noodle salad. I'm not kidding.
Like,
it meant something. I think one was a deeply Kugel Jewish memory, and the other was a memory of wasps and picnics.
Right.
I mean, I think it was in that zone, and I was just there watching them. And Jack got really frustrated. We were in the makeup trailer, and he said something like, fuck it, or who cares?
Yeah.
And then there was a beat, and he said, the only art I have left is not to say that.
Really?
Yeah, which meant that he is still this journeyman actor who goes, I'm not going to say fuck it. And I'm not going to take my ball and go home. I'm going to stay in.
That's touching.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
I know. People think of him as this, like, bolt of lightning that people caught in a jar.
Right.
He was actors.
He's a pro.
Yeah.
Well, there's a great story that I think it must have been Rob Reiner told me about A Few Good Men, because he directed that, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And Jack would, you know, when they were doing Kevin's coverage or Tom's coverage, whoever, Kevin Pollak's coverage, when he was on the stand, Jack would always sit there and just go all in.
Yeah. No, he's the real thing.
Right. And Rob at some point said, you know, you don't have to do the whole, you can just do the line. You don't have to go. He's like, I love to act.
Yeah. I love actors. That's the thing I've directed recently.
Yeah.
And you just I just love actors.
Well, you sent me that movie that you directed, and I watched it. Then She Found Me. That was your first film.
Yeah.
Wait, and you chose that. You chose that movie. You championed that movie.
I did.
Took that all the way through. You wrote it.
Yeah, yeah. That one, and then another one called Ride that I did after that. I wrote.
But that's original script, right?
That's original. This one went through a lot of iterations, and then me trying to get pregnant, writing about trying to get pregnant. None of that was. It was based on a novel by Eleanor Lipman, but was very as beautiful, and uh-huh. the DNA of what she wrote is in the movie, but everything else was different.
Very Jewish.
Deeply Jewish. David Steinberg said I'm the most Jewish actor he's ever worked with, which, given my Shiksa goddess reputation. No, David Steinberg, you know.
Oh, the comedian.
Yeah.
Oh, okay,
you're David
okay.
Steinberg.
Oh, yeah, that's right. When did you work with him?
Mad About You.
Oh, right.
And
right.
I had, when I was nine, I memorized all of his records, which he couldn't square that with this blonde.
Him, of all people.
I know.
You're a big David Steinberg fan of the stand-up.
Yeah.
Huh.
Disguised as a normal person.
I don't know. He's one of those guys that I kind of like. I don't know why I don't have a knowledge of his stand-up work, of all the people. Because I like a lot of old stand-ups, but I just never, like, he's a Canadian dude.
Yeah.
And I don't know the stand-up.
You know what Seinfeld said about him?
What?
David not only has balls, he has quality balls. That was a high compliment.
That is from him.
Yeah.
So what were the first, how did you start acting?
I was in this class,
right, the
and
one
an
you said,
agent
yeah.
called the yeah. teacher and said, I need a girl. I went, auditioned, and I was suddenly on a plane for Canada to play the pioneer daughter in a thing called Pioneer Woman. So cut to me in like a bonnet running, going, I guess this is acting.
Yeah. And did your mom have to go with you?
My mom went with me. She tells a story that she came over to see if I was okay, and I looked at her and said, I know what I'm doing. But I don't remember if that's true.
Oh,
or not.
Yeah. That's a
ultimately,
nice story.
It would become true.
Yeah, right.
If it wasn't true then, it's true in the big
picture. It sounds like something a precocious kid would say.
Yeah.
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 So that was the beginning of it?
That was the beginning, and I was always in regular school, like, because I was never in a hit show.
Right.
I didn't get kidnapped in that way. I had a regular life and friends. And
oh, that's probably and then better.
I think it's better.
You didn't, like, become one of those freaks.
And the pain of not getting these parts that I thought I would have no career if I didn't get, you know, this part. Or that was a whole Brat Pack that passed me by and the whole...
Were you jealous of it? Who were they? Which ones?
All of them.
They mean, like...
Breakfast Club.
Oh, right. And Ringwald and Ali Sheedy and Judd Nelson.
I wanted to be all those
Anthony
people.
Michael
I was
Hall.
Never quite
there
in
are
there.
There are contemporaries, aren't they, actually?
I guess so. Yeah. You think of them still as... No, they're all our age.
Right. But that would have been the time. That's what was happening with the acting kids.
Yeah. Yeah.
Emilio Estevez.
Yes.
Right?
Yep. And I was later in a movie that he directed. He's cool. Have you had him on your
show? I have not talked to him.
They have good genes in terms of decency and brains, those sheens.
Do they?
I mean, I don't know the other ones, but I know Emilio and I know Martin. I've worked with Martin
one's
twice.
One's kind of a wild card.
Yes, I can't speak to that. But thank God.
He definitely has the genes, apparently.
He has some genes.
He's kicking. Yeah, you know, he's still going.
Yes, exactly.
And he's put himself through quite a bit.
Yes.
Still alive.
Yeah, totally.
I'm fascinated with that crew, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there was a movie called Cattle Annie and Little Britches about two girl cowboys, and it was ended up Amanda Plummer and Diane Lane, and I thought, that's it. That was my chance. Oh. I auditioned horseback riding, and, they just put you through everything,
I
didn't get it, I thought for sure,
it was over.
Oh, well.
But you did, I mean, it took a while, man.
To get through my IMDb?
To sort of really land in it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. It took a long time.
I mean, it's kind of like impressive. I'm
volume, if nothing else.
Well, I mean, just like just the TV stuff. I mean, you were going for a lot.
It's fun to watch your face shock at just if it was about quantity.
But like the Mary Tyler Moore show?
I know. I was Murray's daughter. This is the thing. I don't know what to do with this information. Because on Blindspotting, everyone is 30, 29.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
And I just have, I'm the guy, older person now with the stories. And I try to like just bite my tongue because no one wants to hear.
But it's fortunate that you're the old person with the stories that all of them can identify from your career. Like, there's some people that have been at it forever, and I don't know them.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I guess so.
Like, you know, you like have some gravitas at least.
But I don't even know what they know. Like, I know. Given their weird demographic, like, what did they see? Twister, they saw. What else? What do they know me from?
They kind of have to know you from Mad About You. They
yes,
have to
I guess
know
so.
You. Of course.
I don't know.
Even if they didn't watch, they saw a billboard, a commercial, something.
I'm great in the Mad About You commercials.
Awesome.
Amazing. Some of my best work.
But when you're doing this stuff, I mean, like, when you're on the set with, like, Mary Tyler Moore, are you absorbing things?
Yeah. I mean, that was weird because I'd watched that one. A lot of the things that I did when I was a kid, they were so obscure. I'm like, yeah. I guess am I in outer space or where am I? I'm wherever they say
yeah,
I am.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
That one I grew up watching. You
right.
Know, it was Saturday night or whatever it was.
Yeah.
So suddenly I'm in there.
Yeah.
That was a trip. But mostly they were more obscure than that. And then...
But did you find that you learned all that you know on the job as opposed... Because...
No. Studied acting
you
class
did?
Acting. Yeah, my dad was my dad forever. Larry Moss forever.
Really?
Improv with Gary Austin, you know, started the Groundlings.
Yeah.
I started studying with him when I was 16. Decades and decades and decades.
No kidding.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And your dad taught you?
Yeah, forever.
And what do we know that he did?
He was the casting director. He directed in New York, and then we needed more money. So
yeah.
He got a job as the casting director of the Mark Taper Forum. And it was when that theater was... you know, Zoot Suit for the
yeah.
first time. Children of a Lesser God, there'd never been deaf theater that had come up. Great White Hope with James Earl Jones. Like that
one
place.
Downtown?
Yeah, that
oh,
place,
wow.
Which now gets, you know, wonderful transplants from Broadway. It was alive with things that no one had seen. Leonard Bernstein's
kind of
Mast, you know
uh-huh.
that show? It's a crazy drug trip, operatic,
uh-huh.
wild thing, which I saw 10 times because my dad worked there. And so I'd do my homework in his office and then go see Leonard Bernstein's Mast for the 10th time.
He was what was his job?
He was
job?
The casting director.
Casting director.
But he was one of the crew of people who would go to the invited dress rehearsal and he'd bring around his,
right.
you know, 10-year-old daughter who for some reason was into it. I just loved it.
Why wouldn't you? So it was sort of an experimental space in a lot of ways?
I mean, it was a legitimate theater,
right.
but it wasn't presenting already
right.
presented
right.
Broadway shows.
Right.
It was the place you went for Tony Kushner. Angels in America started
oh,
there.
Yeah.
I saw it before it ever, before George Wolfe even directed it. Gordon Davidson directed it.
Wow. I just saw, I
was
saw.
Like, what am I seeing? What am I seeing?
I was like, that's a mind blowing. That's
oh
mind blowing.
God.
I saw Linda Vista there, Tracy Letts's last piece.
I haven't seen it.
It's great. I mean, he's great.
Yeah. Slave Play is going to come there. Have you seen Slave Play?
No, I've heard about it.
You have to buckle your seatbelt.
Where'd you see that? New York?
Yeah.
You still go to theater all the time?
All the time. That's been one of the most painful parts about the last year, just
no
waiting
theater?
And waiting and waiting. Yeah.
You love it.
At some point, like in my early 20s, I thought, am I going to get bored of acting? And then I started working on Shakespeare and thought, you'll never be anything but scrambling to survive if you do it. So you will not be bored. You might you might be mediocre, but you will not be bored.
I guess you can spend a lifetime trying to kind of, you know, get into those, into the depth of it.
And we're at a disadvantage. You know, there's people in the UK who are doing their fourth.
They just talk like that?
They talk like that, but they also are doing their fourth viola
yeah.
and their third lyric.
Yeah.
You know, that's how you really do it well.
Yeah.
But I still like trying.
Yeah. I mean, I'm an idiot about Shakespeare, and I'm always slightly, not condescending, but dismissive, like anyone cares what I think. I mean, that's not the hill I want to die on,
yes.
but I'm sort of like, I don't get it. Like, it's going to matter that I don't get Shakespeare.
Or that's going to be the thought that wins the day at the
yeah.
end.
Well, it's just a listening thing, man. Because, like, you know, these things go on a while, and you got to stay in the saddle with it, and you'll glean what's happening, even if you don't quite get the language.
But I think I know why.
Yeah.
That's all I know. I don't know how to
okay.
do it that well, but I think it's because, do you know the show Sunday in the Park with George?
Yeah.
Okay, so it's written, not only is it about this painter, it's actually, the music is pointless painting, right?
Oh,
and
right.
So Shakespeare, you hear Lear and it's like a storm.
Yeah, oh, okay.
It's actually, so even if you don't get right. it, something's happening to you.
You feel it.
Yeah.
Right. You can kind of, and also the stories are pretty classically structured.
Yeah, totally.
You know, you're like, that guy's
in they
trouble.
Are actually the classically yeah. They are classically structured.
Right. Like the Greeks.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, I mean I think it's a matter of spending more time with it. I don't know. Maybe I will. I've all of a sudden started watching Renoir movies because I'm reading some book by David Thomas. Is that his name? David Thomas, the British critic.
I don't know.
And about directors, and it's like, you know, I haven't watched the Renoir films.
I haven't either.
Yeah, here I am going again. Who has? A lot of people.
I haven't.
Important film
important
brains.
People.
There's a couple I saw in films in film class, but now I'm like, I'm watching other ones. I'm like, all right, okay. But maybe I'll get to Shakespeare. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah.
But it could happen.
Yeah.
So, but what did your father land on in films? He was a film director too, wasn't he?
No. No? TV a little. He did Mad About You, and that started off a kind of 15th career. At 70, he was starting a new career.
I remember that, reading about that.
He won a DGA award for directing Carl Reiner in an episode that Carl Reiner was in.
He directed a lot of Mad About You?
He did.
Your
we
dad.
Had one that was one. I don't know if you saw the show or remember the show, but yeah. We had one that was one shot.
Yeah, that was him?
Not one take, but one camera. Yeah.
Did you get him the job?
Kind of. But yeah. He had been around. Everybody sure. This is the kindest man you've ever met.
Nice guy.
Beyond.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I run into people all the time who put their hand on their heart and say, "Your dad." So, he, you know, it was a pretty easy ask.
Yeah.
And Paul loved him, and he did one, and he won a DGA award. So it wasn't like, can my dad do the show?
Right, you know? No, right.
Yeah.
But he did, so he did a lot of television.
Yeah, he did a lot of television. And then after that, then he kind of aged out of that because they wanted young people.
Yeah.
And he started directing motion capture video games, like when he was 80.
Really?
Yeah.
How do
you... This is my North Star. It's pretty good. Yeah.
It's great. And your mom was, what did she?
She's very alive and is a photographer. And
she never did the show business thing?
No.
And you have brothers and sisters?
I have an older sister, yeah.
But she's
I'm sort of the one.
The one? The star?
Oh, God. Why, when you say it, I flinch? I'm whatever. I'm an actor. Why do I flinch so bad when you said it?
I don't know. I'm just curious because as an actor and as somebody who teaches acting, so you go through all these classes. So the person who created tell me about this Moss guy.
Larry Moss.
I heard his name.
Yeah, he's fancy.
Yeah.
I mean, that part, he coached me for As Good As It Gets. I said his name on the Oscars, and then I was like, I can't get you on the phone. What happened?
Oh, really?
Because he coached a lot of great.
So he was
teaching acting before I said his name at the Academy Awards and was brilliant. And then I think a couple of well-known people said his name and now he's highly celebrated. Yeah, very much. I worked with him on Blindspotting.
So when you get a coach, you bring them on, they're on set with you?
No. I've never done that. I go see them if there's not a global pandemic.
Oh, to try to figure out to figure out what the character wants, how to shape the character, those kind of questions?
Yeah, and I can go pretty deep with him. I've known him a long time.
Uh-huh.
I was in a movie where I was supposed to slap this boy who's my son.
Yeah.
And I was really freaked out about it. And he went, "Why?" And I said, "I don't know. I'm freaked out about it." And so he got down on his knees. He was like, "Slap me in the face. I said, you're not going to kill me."
Just, yeah.
And I hit like a wall. And he's the kind of person that can see the wall and go, "Let's figure a way around or through or something."
Right, yeah.
The fun of acting for me now.
What would you figure out?
I don't know if I figured out the psychological
answer.
No,
why couldn't you slap the kid?
I don't know. But I did, ultimately. I did. But I didn't like it.
Right.
I didn't like
it. But you couldn't find the obstacle.
I get great joy in a lot of things I get to do as an actor.
Not
slapping Haley Joel Osment did not make me happy. No.
Oh, yeah. That's who it was.
Yeah,
that's it.
Sweetest kid on earth.
Yeah, tough face to hit.
Yeah,
yeah,
really tough.
Oh, that was which movie was that?
Pay It Forward.
Pay It Forward.
Yeah,
with Spacey.
Yeah.
Oh,
oh, yeah.
It's a whole other story there.
Yes.
So, but by the time you get, tell me about the person who created the Groundlings.
Gary Austin. I heard your interview with Lorraine Newman, and she talked about him.
He was
Ground Zero of the Groundlings. And there was Lorraine and Tim Matheson and three or four other people, it was Gary. And when I was 16, my dad had met Gary and did a class with him or said, I think it would be fun. So I went to the Groundling Theater at 16 years old, and it turns out it was a marathon class, so 6 hours of improv.
Mm.
And there were only like 6 people in there, which means you were constantly working, and I'd never improvised.
Huh.
Have you done improv?
I improvise my own thing, but not really with... Yeah, I've done movies, whole movies of improv. What am I saying? I've not done much stage improv, but I've improvised films, and improvise stand-up, but I haven't done the stage ones.
So the thing, all of the improv games that you do in your own class are designed to wear down your desire to look cool.
Right.
Right. You're just, right. You want to get to the point where you're perfectly happy to be an idiot. That's all those guys on SNL. They don't care. They're like sociopaths.
Oh, that's what it is. Right.
Right. Something has to chip away at the part of you that goes,
ego?
I don't want to look dumb.
Yeah.
But I got thrown in a very deep pool with like six groundlings and I'm 16 and I didn't have like lunch money. So I was hungry. It was a whole thing. But all I know is I left and I was like, when can I go back? And then for the following ever.
Yeah.
I've been improvising with him until he passed away. And then I have a friend named Rob Watsky who has a place called Turbine Arts. I improvise with them.
Do people know this about you?
No, nobody knows anything about me. I'm the worst celebrity in the world. I wear the same khaki pants and do the same six things. My publicist said to me, you are the worst celebrity ever. A picture of you is worth 5 cents because you're not doing anything exciting. I just don't talk about it or something. I don't know.
But shouldn't people know to go watch?
Probably.
I mean, so you go riff?
I do. Everything's pandemic. So before the pandemic, he would do Sunday improv things. And I think in one of the cases, there was no back door for security. Didn't want to announce it. You know what
okay.
I mean? So
okay.
I would just sneak in and we'd do our thing.
How many people?
There might be 8 of us on stage and
wow.
Yeah, really fun. And whereas the Groundlings became, I think, a lot about characters, doing characters.
Yeah.
This other work that came out of Gary's work was more about relationship. Like you don't have to, there's a thing when you study improv, establish the who, what, and where.
Right.
So I come in and I say, hi, Dad. I'm late for school, let's go, right? So everybody feels calm because they know what's happening.
Right.
But in this other version, I might come in and just start shaking my head. And then you might shake your head. And we assume we both know what we're doing. And then somebody says, I can't believe it. And then you say, I can't believe it either. I'm so sorry. And you know what I mean? You trust for a minute.
Someone's got to throw the big card in, though, right?
At some point. But not rushing is kind of cool because you're out there
I can feel it.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, because you're just going on the emotion of the moment and playing off the other person.
Trusting something will happen.
And then if it goes one way and you're not acting that way, then it has its own comic dynamic.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, that's exciting.
I love it.
And you just do this because you have fun?
Yep.
So now Paul Reiser, you talk to him?
Yeah, often.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, do you know him?
No, I mean, we did.
Did he do your show?
Years ago.
Oh.
And it was kind of weird. You know, it was okay, but I don't think it was before this was really defined.
Mm-hmm.
But we had a nice talk. He was one of the first guys I remember I told him this story because it goes nowhere.
And let's hear it again.
Let's do it again. No, I just I remember seeing him in Diner and I remember seeing him do some stand up on TV, but he didn't really stay a stand up long in a way. You know, he was one and he was a known one, but it wasn't what he was known for.
What was he known for? Acting?
Yeah, for your show and for,
right.
Right. And he was one of the early guys to really get big roles, you know, as a comic that weren't comic roles necessarily. But I saw him at the comic strip in New York and I was in college. I remember walking up to him going I really want to do stand up. You know, he was just sitting by himself. What do I do? He's like, well, you just got to do it. I'm like, great. Thank you. Thanks for helping out.
Was it true, though, in a way?
Well, of course it's true, but it's you don't know how, but that's
right.
What's he going to tell me? Find an open mic, do whatever, because he came up in a different time.
What I can tell you about him is that before I ever met him, he was in Larry Moss's acting class and I was observing. So in terms of people who do stand-up who then become actors, he's the real deal.
Well, no, I think he always wanted
he's
to be an actor.
Real
I think that's
deal.
Why he did stand-up.
Yeah.
Is what I recall.
He's doing stand-up again, though, so he must love it. Right before the pandemic, he was doing it all. He was going to the Ice House
to bring
it back to him. Anyway, but on that show,
He must be doing it for the same reason you're doing improv.
Yeah, he likes it.
Yeah.
But I was working, I really felt like I was going toe-to-toe with an incredible actor.
Paul?
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah. I got certain kinds of attention that he didn't get.
Right.
But it was a trick because it was totally what I did was funny because what he did, you know, it was one performance.
Yeah.
And I think he was underappreciated.
It feels like he has he's shown it. He's got a pretty impressive emotional range. He's able to sort of open it up.
He's deeply empathetic. I don't know what people think on the outside because I feel like I've never been on the outside with him. We met and we were like, let's go.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
So what was that? What was that process like? You've done 900 shows already.
That no one saw.
Yeah.
That 30 people saw. I had finally been in movie. You know, back in the day, yeah. I don't know if you remember it, but if you were on TV, you didn't get to be in movies.
Right.
And if you were in TV or movies, you really didn't get to do a play in New York. That was like the harder jump
was from TV to movies. If you were known for TV.
Right. And I was just known enough to not get movies. And then I started getting movies. I was in Mr. Saturday Night, speaking of comedy.
Sure. Yeah. He became that guy, you know.
they should reshoot it now. And I was in a movie called The Water Dance that I loved. That was maybe the first movie that I felt.
This is before Mad
About
You.
Thing. Yeah. And so I did not want to go back and do a TV show. And I really didn't want to do a sitcom, which at that point was the least cool thing you could be doing if you were trying to be a serious actor. And he came to a dinner party at my house.
Paul did.
Yeah. His wife knew my roommate, and there he was.
Interesting.
And then the next day, will you read this pilot I have? And I thought, I'm going to have that. I don't want to do this. And then it arrived and it said the untitled Paul Reiser. I'm like, I'm going to be the wife. And,
yeah.
And then I read it and thought, this is really good. And it's a really good part.
Yeah.
And I'd love to do it. So it was like in an instant.
Yeah.
I hope I get to be in it.
And that was that.
And that was that.
And he wanted you?
Yeah. Yeah.
So interesting to me. And that that was the time where there's only a few shows that do what that did. Do you know what I mean?
It was everything the opposite of what I thought. I thought it would be an easy schedule because I would hear things about four camera shows. We worked till 2 in the morning. My body broke down from the stress of it. Yeah. And I also thought, I'll get bored of this. And I never got bored of it.
Why was that? Because the showrunner was why?
Because it's a different style. Like Friends was more successful than we were, but we tried every week to have it a marriage issue and a scene that actually resolved. You didn't just end on the funny line. Like our style, not better or worse.
Right.
It had a one act play vibe that none of us could stand with, like hearing an off note if you're a musician. If it didn't have a full thing, if it didn't have structure and
you have to keep chipping away.
We'd be there chipping away.
So
and
the writers
showrunners
be...
came and went, Paul and I were like, two and me, and we both know when it's not working. So
right. And then by that, I imagine by whatever season 2 or 3, people knew how to write for the thing. Ish.
Some.
Yeah.
Some yes, some no. And we were picky.
Yeah,
you know, it mattered to us to walk the line of silly and farce and something real about trying to love somebody. And
had you been married at that point yet?
No,
not through any of it.
No, but I'd been in relationships. I mean, we all brought our stories in. You know what I mean?
Oh, really?
Dumped them desperately. 22 episodes.
To the writers?
Yeah, 22 episodes.
A year.
I mean, my God, and sometimes 24 episodes.
Yeah.
It's a lot.
How many did you do total?
I had 100 billion. I don't know.
Isn't that crazy?
It's crazy.
Do you still get checks for it?
In fact, no, I think I got my big one and then it was over. Paul gave me as a wrap gift a bound leather book and the title is Why I'm So Tired and it's every line I said for 7 years.
That's hilarious.
I know.
It's 162 episodes.
There you go. It's
and you did it again. Did you do it again?
Yeah. We did 12 right before the pandemic about Empty Nest and the daughter leaving. And
what was the idea there? Was the idea that you were going to keep it going or you just wanted to knock out 12?
We thought people were going to be like banging down our door, to be honest. It was Peter Toland. Do you know Peter Toland?
Yeah,
I mean, he's a great guy and a great writer. Rescue Me. And
we
had him. So you had the old DNA of the show and this voicey guy to not let it just be old and tired.
Yeah.
We had a real reason to do it, which is their kid is leaving. That's a season.
Yeah.
We know when we hit on something that's a season.
Right.
Infertility was a season.
Right.
You know, all that. We were like, how are we going to choose between Amazon and Netflix? And nobody bought it.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Oh, was it
Isn't that crazy?
Sad?
We were just so humble. Like, how could they not want? We'd pitch it and they'd be scream laughing.
Right.
I can't believe we're seeing you together. And he and I, if he were here, you'd see. It's a thing. It's that chemistry is the tired word, but it is real.
Like you were married.
Yeah. You know, I just love him and he makes me laugh. And, and then finally somebody bought it. It was really hard to get it made. Now it's on Amazon, but it's like that thing of come and do 3 seasons wasn't even
an option.
So I didn't have to.
So what'd you walk away feeling after that? Old?
Glad we did it.
Yeah.
Glad we did it. And it was so white. You know, I look back at all those shows, but I'll just talk about mine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the asleep at the wheel lack of
diversity.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So that became my and our, you know, we had directors that were only women of color and men of color, and the cast shifted. You know, we just did our awkward best to say, let's at least
be inclusive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Deeply. I mean, no kidding around.
The
crew was as diverse as I've worked with. And that takes, you have to, you know,
you it's great,
pushing
though.
Against the tide to make it happen. But if you, it was one of the few times that I'm like, I'm actually kind of half in charge here, and that's what we're doing.
Well, it's great because, like, there's so many voices represented. Like, the idea, like, I how it got so institutionalized is through nepotism and through just sort of, you know, and I don't know if it was entitlement, but I just don't think anyone really thought or knew better the institutional racism involved. But I was on GLOW, and that couldn't have been a more diverse set on all levels.
The crew, too?
Yeah, everybody. And it was like, it feels like what, you know, people being together should feel like.
That's it.
Yeah.
Well, I did a show called Shots Fired that Gina Prince Bythewood did about sort of a Ferguson-like event.
Mm-hmm.
And the first day of shooting, Ferguson happened. So it was one of those, like,
wow.
China syndrome, horrible oppression things. But I got to the set in Atlanta, and I bet it was 75% black crew.
Uh-huh.
And I went, oh, my God. I have been,
right.
as we've established for 100 years, walking onto this white supremacy factory of movie making. And
right.
so that shifted, you know, this is what blind spotting, this is what I play in blind spotting, the awkward white ally
right.
who is at least opening her mouth, you know?
Well, that's like an interesting place to be because it's always, that's, anyone who's an ally is an awkward, in white is an awkward white ally.
Yeah.
Like, because there's no real way to be like, I was on board with this. I'm one of you guys.
No, that's,
you know?
That's trap number two. Yeah, for sure.
So let me ask you, like, in terms of, so you win an Oscar, you're on this long running show. Now, because I was talking to my producer about this, that there's this assumption, and certainly it's an assumption, I think it's with men, that you do these things, and after a certain point, you make a certain amount of money with for the right people. You can do whatever you want.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, like, because you won a fucking Oscar. And it didn't seem like right after that it was like...
I know. It feels terrible to hear you say it, but it's true. I mean, I don't know. I wanted to have a real life. I knew that.
Yeah.
I mean, it was weird. And in 1 year, I won every one of those awards you can win because
right.
I was doing both things at once and both happened to explode.
Mad About You or this? Yeah.
Everything.
Yeah.
I won everything
Emmy
for
and
every,
Oscar.
All
yeah, right.
at once.
All right. Okay.
And I was 30-something.
Yeah.
I'd like to have a baby one day. What about a real life? And I got a little bit of vertigo that things were going to be...
Were you married at the time?
I was with somebody that I was wanting to have a baby with. So I got married in there somewhere.
Yeah.
And I got scared that I would be this lifer who never had a life. You know what I mean?
Okay. So it's partially your choice.
Partially. That does not mean if Martin Scorsese had said, please come play this part, I would have kept working. So it's some combination of both.
Right.
I stepped back from a few things because I thought, I'm only now a thing that's acting. I'm not like a thing that's drawing on her life to act. That spooked me a little.
Yeah.
And the lack of privacy. Like, for 1 minute, I was famous, like followed everywhere famous.
Right.
That waned, thank God. But I thought it would be forever.
Right.
That
yeah.
really freaked me out.
Yeah.
Then I got boring. Wore the same khakis in every picture and it quieted down.
Right.
I also, like, made a whole person, wrote and directed 2 movies.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
No,
like,
I know what you mean.
Stuff. But I hear that. What happened? And I go, I don't know. I haven't stopped for 1 second.
No,
and
I know. But I guess that's true. Like, I don't mean to contribute to that narrative
that's okay,
of what's
but
happened.
There it
but
is,
I was just
I
wondering how, if you felt that there was any resistance, you know, in terms of professional resistance.
No, because right after I won all those things, I did Castaway and What Women Want. And
those are big.
Yeah, they were all big.
And
big
even
the,
Twister was a huge movie.
Twister was huge. Now when I'm doing press for Blindspotting, all the kids say, "Twist, you were in Twister." Oh
they
my
loved
God.
It.
They loved
it's
it.
Menacing.
Yeah, yeah.
Giant tornadoes.
Yeah.
But but that's true. Those are all big movies.
Yeah. I don't know how much you're supposed to, at what level you're supposed to stay at 10 for decades. I don't know how that's supposed to go. I just had a kind of ebb and flow that came partly, and I never would have written, directed my own thing if... I had been offered a ton of movies. So
sure.
I don't know.
Well, I guess the question is, you feel like you've been able to execute whatever you wanted to do, really?
No, I would love to be too busy to do this interview because I've got a three incredible giant movies waiting for me that, you know what I mean?
To act in or direct?
To act in.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, the thing about directing as a woman is that, yes, people have begun to say hire women.
Yeah.
But speaking of systemic, the thing is, they hire women to do episodic directing.
Right.
And you can work for 10 years like I did twice to make an independent movie.
Yeah.
But until they say, here's a pilot.
Right.
Or until they say, here's a huge franchise.
Right.
Go direct this.
Yes.
Until they put the money in your lap, it's wet Band-Aids. You know what I mean? It's,
it's,
there's a famous thing that as a, you'd have a movie at Sundance that does really well and you're a guy and you're handed a giant franchise movie.
Right.
And you're a woman. You work really hard, you make a movie, it does well, and then you start over. And
with another indie movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I hate to be like a complainer, but I did have that experience.
Yeah. Well, I mean, my girlfriend, who's no longer with us, was a person who did a lot of independent movies.
I thought about her.
Yeah. And she was just starting to do that thing where, you know, you get these big, you know, the episodic, the pilot stuff. But she, like, I guess her... She was interesting in that her attitude was she was sort of an auteur thinker. Like, you know, like she wanted to have the control of all those movies she made. Like, and when the one time that she was on the dole from a studio,
she hated
it was a problem.
It's terrible.
Yeah.
It's terrible. So I don't have, I mean, I would only want to do that, I guess, in the land of Oz where it doesn't exist, where you're like-minded with the money people.
But how did you feel about the one that I saw, Then She Found Me? Like, in terms of, like, what'd you learn from that?
I mean, my heart and soul is in that movie and the other movie I directed called Ride and this movie I was in called The Sessions. Like, at my funeral,
that was a big
just
movie,
tell
the
them
Sessions.
To put, to watch that.
Yeah.
Do you know James Hellman? Do you know that writer?
Uh-uh.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
The Soul's Code. He wrote a book called The Soul's Code.
Okay.
He's incredible.
Yeah.
Jewish Jungian writer. Is already an interesting cocktail.
Yeah. Sure.
I used essays of his as the sort of North Star for both of those things. But he says something about biography, which is look at somebody's work when they're gone rather than anything anybody writes about them. Because, like,
it's there.
It's in there. And,
sure.
And Then She Found Me was about betrayal and betrayal by God. And maybe that's part of it rather than some mistake.
Right.
Those are big things. You know, that's a life
theme. It's heavy, man.
I know. I know. It is heavy.
Well, yeah, because there's that scene, like, you know, where, you know, where she won't say the prayer.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't know. I don't know. What is your relationship? Do you talk? Do you have a spiritual relationship?
I do. I have my own. I'm in the other rooms that you're not in.
Oh, yeah.
I'm in adjacent rooms.
Oh, okay.
And,
I dig.
Yeah. And if somebody says, do you believe in God, then I freeze up.
Right.
But I definitely, like anybody, look up during a pandemic when my kid looks scared and goes, come on, help me. Help me. So that's what that movie was about. Like,
were you brought up with religion?
No. My dad meditated his whole life. I've meditated since.
Like TM or just other
ones? My dad did TM. Back to David Steinberg. So the first season of Mad About You, I got so overwhelmed that my body started to, I got weird arthritis that's now gone.
Really?
My body gave out. And then we took a break, and I had knee surgery. They said, there's nothing wrong. This is like a stress thing. And I came back and I said, season two, I need time to do physical therapy. And David Steinberg said, you ever meditate? And I had taken a class when I was 18. And I remember thinking, if I did this every day, my life would be different.
The TM?
And then I blew it off.
Right.
Yeah. It's a Tibetan Buddhist thing, but it's even simpler than TM. There's no mantra.
Breath.
On the exhale, you're done. Thinking when you think.
That's what I've been doing.
Don't
like
you?
I've been trying for the last few months, just a Headspace app, and it's all about the breathing. Do you still do it?
Every day since I was 29, thanks to David Steinberg.
Okay,
but I mean every day.
Yeah, well, Lynn did it twice a day, but she was TM person.
All the same. It's all the same. It is the same. I really think it is.
But where am I supposed to get?
What do you mean? Oh, where are you supposed to get? You poor thing. You know, not miserable.
No, I'm not miserable, but like when I do it, like I find that like I'm learning the tool of, you know, acknowledging the thought and then, you know, kind of moving them aside and getting into the breath and staying present. But I'm not entirely sure that I'm not thinking about not thinking.
All right. I'm not a master, but here's what I know. You're not supposed to not think. If you're not thinking, you're dead. Mm. It's just noticing it back to the breath.
Sure. Yeah, I can do that. Yeah.
Whereas the other, what's 24 hours minus 20 minutes, you're just, you know, that phrase monkey mind, you're just leaping from thought to thought for 20 minutes.
Yeah.
When I realize I'm thinking, which might be 19 minutes into meditating, I'm going to go, right, thinking, and go back to the breath.
So that's, okay.
And someone told me early on, don't ever judge the meditation. Like, that was a good one.
No, no, just, I'm not doing that. And I do feel that, I do, what do you find that it does for you in a specific way, the tool of it?
I mean, it's almost, I have to answer in reverse. I can't not do it. It's really, okay. It's not like a thing that's a bonus to my day. Like, I'm in deep in the red if I don't do it.
But like, is it, do you find yourself, like, in day-to-day life, the ability to separate between, you know, present and you know, stopping the noise? Is that something you can engage now? I know it's a weird question, but
no,
I'm trying to figure out what the benefit is.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, but I think it's huge.
Yeah.
When I've gone through really bad, in like right around the time the sessions came out, I went through bad, like something really bad, trauma.
Oh, really?
Without going into it, because there's kids, it was bad. It was like a bad one.
Oh.
And I couldn't sit there. My meditation was I would listen to somebody for 5 minutes. You know, it was too much.
Right.
But other than that, and I'm sure meditating for decades leading up to it helped me not completely fall off the side
into,
of the
into
world.
The sadness.
Yeah. I don't even know how to describe it. I just couldn't not do it at this point.
No, I mean, I get it. Like, and I understand why it's good, and I have been doing it, and I think it does make a difference. But, you know, there's still, like, things get dark still.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly.
Oh, did no one tell you that?
No, I know that.
No, they for sure do.
I know that some of that darkness is something my mind is generating that's not really hinged to anything.
Yeah.
But it comes.
Well, I guess the theory, and again, I don't, you know, what do I know? But I guess the theory is in the same way you get in the habit of going, oh, there's a thought, back to the breath.
Sure, sure. This will pass.
There's my heartbreak, back to the breath.
Right, right.
I'm hungry,
right,
back to the breath.
Right,
this is going really well, back to the breath. I'm a piece of shit. You know, like they all, I guess for 20 minutes you hope
that
they... So
you don't hang on the piece of shit one?
Well, I think maybe what I would say for 20 minutes they all have equal weight.
No,
my heart is broken.
Right.
I forgot to feed the cat. Like, it's
all
the same.
Yeah, the world is ending.
That seems kind of worth
it. Sure. Yeah, they're all the same.
It's all the same.
Yeah, but they're, for me, in waking life, you know, outside of meditation, they're all the same, only it's menacing.
Right.
Yes. Everything has the same importance. Like, you know, my cat, is my cat sick? Why is the world on fire? It's all coming at me the
same. I'm with you. Me too.
Yeah, you too?
Yeah. Yeah. Hmm. Yeah.
But you do the other thing.
I meditate, yeah.
And
I have
go to the
fellowship.
Other, the other.
I do.
Yeah. That's
I've had lots of therapy.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Still?
Yeah. Not all the time now, but yes.
Yeah, I don't do it all the time either.
I had a big chunk with a pretty brilliant Jungian that changed my brain.
Really?
Yeah.
The Jungian. So archetypes, collective unconscious, the dream life.
Yeah. For me, what it did, because I certainly can't speak like a scholar, is that when you feel flooded because whatever is happening is so enormous, someone can say, right, and here's a story about Demeter and Persephone, and it's ancient, and her daughter's abducted, and winter forever, and you go, that's where I am on the map. Okay, I'm somewhere.
Right.
I'm somewhere.
It's
I'm not the only
about.
Yeah, I'm not, it's not, my story isn't some mistake.
Yes.
Some like aberration.
This is a human myth.
Yeah, like God didn't fall asleep and then my shit happened.
Right, you're
like,
not the
mine
one.
Is in the thing.
Right.
That was a big deal to me.
Well, it's a big deal to me, in given what I've gone through and in my life, to realize, like, it's not unusual.
Yeah.
Tragedy happens.
Yeah. I don't know is there a story? Is it Romeo and Juliet? I don't know what would speak
to your
experience.
No, I don't either, but it's just like, you know, you're not the victim here necessarily.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, there are these things that, you know, that they're life lessons that have been written about forever, where you just sort of like, nothing, if you're a human, it's happened. Whatever you think is special.
Right. Well, that's the thing.
Yes.
Yeah. It's this. But I will also say, though, I've heard this term lately, spiritual bypass.
I don't know what that is.
That's be careful of that one.
I don't know what that is.
Everybody's been through that. It's no big deal. So I just won't feel heartbroken right now. You know what I mean? You try to use meditation, all this good stuff to wiggle out of sometimes I'm just crying.
Well, I don't have a problem with that. What I think I'm adverse to is a victim mindset.
Me too. And it's and I could go right there with God on my side and flowcharts right. and proof.
Right.
Oh, it's terrible.
It's a martyry thing or whatever. Like, I don't want to be. Yeah, it's an either you got that thing in you or you don't.
Yeah.
So I kind of push back on that.
Yeah, for
I don't,
sure.
I don't mind the crying and the heartbreak. Yeah. And, you know, and trying to be funny in the face of it.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't want, you know, there's, the grievancing is too much.
Yeah. And then the gratitude helps a little, right?
I try that.
You back. I want everyone else to see your face like you ate bad white fish.
With the gratitude?
This is what you look like. This is off. This salmon is off.
How do you experience gratitude? Do you make a list?
Sometimes. I have a friend I call, three things, you know, whatever. My dad did it all the time. My dad would be in, we'd be in the middle of whatever, lunch.
Right.
Can you believe we get to sit here?
Oh, really?
And, I mean, really, all the time. That's how he lived. Huh. So I have that.
Well, then how'd you get nuts?
I don't know.
Who's your original qualifier? I have them. Yeah.
I have them.
Yeah.
I guess there's a thing of I'm my own qualifier. That's right. That's when you're really black belt.
I think that's true. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, when you get into the graduate level codependency.
Is it my room, your graduate school? Isn't that what they say?
Well, yeah. No, it is kind of. But then there's also SLAW, SLAA, which is like Sex Love Addicts Anonymous.
Okay. Don't just get me started. But
love addicts. I mean, the sex thing has its own connotations, but love addiction, that's a whole other fucking,
I may be finally cured of that.
Oh, good.
I think it's possible. Poo, knock on wood right now. Yes. Knock on your desk. Thank you very much.
I'm not that, I don't feel encumbered by that stuff. I just get a little, I get a little dry, I get a little cranky. I'm doing stand-up again. It's coming out sort of, dark and angry. And I'm like, why? I was feeling so grounded and really processing. But then I look at everything I've ever done and it's dark and angry. So,
yeah, but
like,
can I just say something? I mean, I know from listening to the show what you've walked through.
Right.
We all just went through the apocalypse. Are you going to come out and be like, on the way here, what would that
on the way here,
like?
The apocalypse happened.
I want to say to you that I appreciate what has at least felt like truth.
Yeah.
If I have like one thing I fucking need.
Yeah, right.
just please truth.
Well,
which
I'm
have experienced
that.
Not that in a pretty epic level.
Yeah.
And so I really appreciate that what I hear when I hear you is like truth, and I'm grateful.
Oh, well, thank you.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I'm doing, but it's like, it's hard sometimes to be the truth guy when people are like, ugh.
Who's doing that?
I don't know that
anybody's doing that.
I'm making them up.
Yeah, I don't think you might
head.
Be. You might be, because I don't see them. I have not met those people.
When was the last time you did comedy?
Yes. Well, that I don't know.
Yeah.
But the people listening to you, I don't see a lot of...
No, that's true.
I don't see a lot of eye rolling.
Yeah, I'm just trying to figure out how to make it... You don't want it to be... You don't want to get stuck in one rut.
Right.
Anger's easy, kind of.
Right.
You angry? Can you be?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't live in that place, but when I don't get the truth, it's like I could, if I was a dragon, I would exhale
really?
And the town would burn, but I don't because I'm not in those same rooms.
Sure.
I don't do it.
Yeah.
I have the voice that goes, but you'll just have to clean it up later. You know that thing that says, take a drink, you'll feel great?
I go, you're
just going to have a headache. So I have that built in.
Yeah.
It's good, but when do you get to burn the village down? You know what I mean? You write something, I guess.
Yeah, when do you?
I don't know. When do you? I'm asking you.
Oh, I can burn the village down every night. I'm going to go to the Comedy Store tonight and burn the village down.
Yeah. It's a living question.
What is this movie that's coming out like? It seems like there's a lot of funny people in it.
Do I have a movie? I'm not kidding when I say do I
How
have
it
a movie?
Ends? What is that?
There's
a lot of funny people in it.
Zoe Lister-Jones, who should be sitting in this chair really soon, I think you would really.
Really?
Oh, she's amazing.
Okay.
I directed her in a TV show she was in with Diane Wiest and a bunch of people.
What TV show is that?
Life in Pieces. There, I remember the name of it. I'm fine. But there was a minute.
Yeah.
She's amazing.
Yeah.
And she and I sort of just dug each other right away.
Yeah.
And I related to her because she wrote and directed movies and not enough people saw them, but I'm like, I see them.
Yeah,
I see them and they mean something to me.
Yeah.
And so right in the beginning of lockdown, she called and said, I don't know how we're going to do it. This is before we all had the PPE and we had it down with the shields and the tests. None of that existed yet. But she described what it's about, which is this woman played by her and her younger self at 15 or something. Uh-huh. It's the last day on Earth. And so she travels around and makes amends and talks to the boyfriend she never had.
Oh, so that's why it's such a huge cast.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And so I drove over there. We all were 6 feet apart. The crew was three. I did one long scene and went home. And it got into Sundance and it's going to be released.
So that's what it is.
I only have one scene. It's one,
and that's why there's so many people.
Yes,
it's a journey.
It's ensemble.
It's a journey.
It is. It is.
But it's almost like she moves through all these people. They all represent something.
Yeah, and then she gets to her mother, which is me.
And oh, really?
Yes.
All I see at the bottom is Pauly Shore as himself. So I'm wondering where that lands.
I don't know what that is.
So did you ever do, weren't involved with, the stand-up world at all, were you?
To me, that is, that is...
But you never went to the Comedy Store back in the day?
I went to all those places, yeah. Do you know Tim Thomerson?
Sure.
So Tim Thomerson, one of my greatest friends.
Yeah, he did the stagecoach bit. Forever.
A lot of comics I know go, well, that was the guy. That was the guy before so many guys. So I worked with him twice, once on a sitcom when I was 16 and once in a B-movie. That's the good thing about being in 5,000 things that nobody sees. I've met a lot of interesting...
Met all of them.
I've met everybody.
Well, it used to be
and a small... And I love some of them, including Thomerson.
It used to be a small town,
I guess,
in
so.
A way.
I guess so.
I remember...
See the same people in auditions. And,
right.
Yeah.
And, I remember talking to, Ed Begley or somebody, and it was
I love Ed Begley.
Sure. In the 70s, it was there was a hierarchy, but, if you were going to the parties, you were going to the parties, right?
Yeah.
And everyone was there.
Yeah.
The entire 70s
I tell people in my class that are young that think they'll never work that, and it's so easy for me to say, but it's true. When I look back at that age 24, 25, out of work... Like, if you had one thing to do, you were happy because you went to the gym and then you had one audition maybe and then you went to Hugo's or Arts Deli.
Sure.
And then you all went to a movie because you had nothing to do.
Right.
That's the most fun I've ever had. And they all want to win an Oscar and of course they should. I didn't have fun. I had fun at Arts Deli with all my actor friends.
Right.
Including Begley.
Yeah?
Yeah.
You knew him back in the day?
I know him forever, St. Elsewhere.
Oh, yeah.
In fact, when I was going through a hard time, I called him up and I said, I'm not doing well. And he said, I'll meet you at the beach. And we picked up trash on the beach. Because he knows the secret. He knows you got to do something like that to get your...
Be of service.
Yeah.
Do the thing.
Yeah, do the thing.
Well, that's sweet.
Yeah.
I'm glad you have good friends.
I have good
friends.
And
I'm glad you're stable and your kid's all right. You're all right.
Yeah, I'm good.
Good. Nice talking to you.
Nice talking to you.
That was Helen Hunt, the actress and film director and human. That was great. Her new series, Blindspotting, premieres next Sunday, June 13th. And obviously you can watch her in anything else, the movie she made, the movie she's in. Yeah, I'm sure you can find that about you playing at all times somewhere in the universe. That's it. Dark Fonzie is me and Dean Del Rey. There are three of them up where you get podcasts. I think it's fun. People seem to like it. So if you want to check that out, go check that out. And now I'm going to play some Texas style blues, later Texas style. Maybe it's Texas. Maybe. I don't know. It's a riff, man. Here's the riff, man.
Boomer lives. Monkey and the Fonda. Cat angels everywhere.
Send letters, ship packages, and pay a lot less with discounted and pay a lot less with discounted cunt and shit fucking balls in your eat your fucking ass with your hand. Send letters, ships, and packages and pay a lot less with discounted rates from USPS, UPS, and more.